Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Vince Houghton. He is a historian, and he's also the curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington. He's out with a brand new book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. Vince, the thing I like about this book is it appeals to so many different ages of people because the stories in here are so fantastic. You've got all these crazy plots that never worked. Why Nuking the Moon for the title?
Partially the publisher, partially it was the chapter that really stood out as the one that really exemplifies what the book is about, where you have this program that is absolutely ludicrous in looking at it from 2019, but at the same time, it had some of the most serious scientists who ever worked in the United States, including the guy who becomes the deputy director of the Apollo program, including Carl Sagan, including Gerard Kuiper, who there's a lot of things in the universe named after him, including the Kuiper Belt. So these are some top people, but they came up together holistically with one of the most ridiculous plans. And that's where it kind of stands out and what this book is all about.
As you put it together, you're going through this and you're looking at these different plots. If they were left on the drawing board, if they were truly left on the drawing board, we wouldn't have any record of them. So where are the records of all of these different abandoned plans at?
So the left on the drawing board part is that these never actually happened. So these are plots and technologies that were planned all the way up until the very last minute. So there's testing, there's certainly money, there's a money trail there where they spent a lot of money developing these different ideas and technologies, and then they got to the point where they were going to be put into practice in the full operation, and for whatever reason they were canceled. In many cases it was the war ended, some other weapon worked, or they're superseded by other technologies. In rare cases, somebody actually said, no, we're not going to do that. But usually that came down to the very end. Like, there's one particular plot in here that went all the way to the White House, and it was finally John Kennedy that said, no, we're not going to do this. So it had gone through every other iteration, you know, whether it was low-level military all the way up to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who all thought it was a great idea until finally John Kennedy said no. So there's a paper trail. And there's a paper trail in the National Archives. There's a paper trail in military archives. There's enough there to let me know what I needed to know to write this book.
As these plans would develop, was the Cold War really the overarching thing that drew these scientists and all these planners into trying these ideas? Was the Cold War the ultimate goal to end the Cold War?
Yeah, so my primary focus for these stories was the Second World War and the Cold War. These are two time periods where the Allies, you know, some of these are British stories as well, so the Allies were truly desperate to come up with new and innovative ways to help win the war, whether it was the hot war of World War II or the Cold War. And that desperation led to some really interesting innovations, and some of them actually worked really well. Those aren't in the book, right? Those are another book of all the desperate innovations that worked great. These were ones that didn't quite get the chance to fail or succeed. They just never made it off the drawing board. And it's because we face this existential threat, the threat of losing our existence. And that created a environment that spurred on some of these, we call them wacky today, but at the time, just interesting ways to try to win this Cold War.
Did you sense that politics played a role in either the development or the nixing of these ideas, depending on who was in the White House at the time?
I would say the nixing is much more relevant than the development part. I mean, the development part usually comes down to the level of the individual scientists or the military personnel or the people within the CIA. A lot of times the funding for these programs were canceled because of political considerations. Not always the White House. Certainly Congress can play a role in this. There are certain programs that were canceled because Congress decided not to fund them. But the politics of the day, and it's not necessarily, it's very hard to kind of look at this as partisan politics. It's more personality driven. So you're looking at the individual in the White House and what their policy goals were. And that has a little bit to do with why some of these programs worked and some did not.
I remember the old TV show, The West Wing, and there was a famous scene in that show where the president and his chief of staff were talking about an idea sort of like this, where people would shoot missiles out of the Defense Department would shoot missiles in outer space. And the president, Martin Sheen, made some comment that, you know, these departments are like Lucy holding the football, and we're always like Charlie Brown running up to kick the football, and then the plans don't work, and we look like we fall on our butts. And I thought of that scene as I read this book, that a lot of these times these people get so excited about it, it's almost a kind of selling a timeshare type of a thing to these administrations and when they don't work. So do you get the sense that people just got overexcited because of the potential of these with no consideration of the reality?
So I try to be that cynical. I try not to think that the scientists and the engineers were trying to pull one over on the people in government. I think the scientists and engineers were just as excited about the possibilities for these programs. I think this was a time, certainly in the 1960s and during the 1940s, during World War II, where true innovation was taking place. And for every single story that's in this book, there's a satellite that works. For every single story that's in this book, there's an SR-71, the world's greatest spy plane. For every story in this book, there's a radar or an atomic bomb or some new and innovative technology that actually works. So I think scientists, this was the heyday where they were getting full funding to do just about anything they wanted to. But there are things few and far between actually trying to take advantage of the government in such a way that, you know, it's kind of like Lucy in the football. I'm not quite cynical enough to go that direction.
The thing that astonished me is how often animals were used for these types of plans. And, I mean, as an animal lover, it just makes me cringe at some of the things these animals went through. But can you kind of explain what the idea was behind using animals for so many of these foiled plans?
Well, they don't say no. I think it's as simple as the fact that, unfortunately, we can use and abuse animals to our heart's extent, and they can't do much about it. And in this case, there are several stories in this book, and actually there's, sadly, multiple stories that it didn't include where animals were used and abused. And this is a time when we were willing to pull out all the stops. You know, these are times when we were truly desperate for, you know, trying to find a way to help win World War II or the Cold War. And animals, unfortunately, were sacrificed to the cause, some more than others. I mean, the plan, Project X-Ray, which is in the book, would have ended up killing hundreds of thousands of bats. That was really the most damaging of all of them, although another program, Blue Peacock, would have likely incinerated some live chickens in a nuclear weapon in the Cold War in the 1950s and 60s. So we had very little respect for our friends in the animal kingdom, particularly in the plans in this book.
And is it to a certain extent that these types of research wouldn't be allowed today?
Some yes and some no. I mean, this is not necessarily where these are programs that are overt. These are clandestine programs at the time. They certainly would be as well today. So where PETA would love, you know, would hate every program that I describe in this book and certainly hate programs like it today, there's no way to know what's actually happening. And so you would think that people would think twice about wanting to use animals in such a way, but when we're talking about top secret programs, we won't know for another 30 years.
Tell me about this International Spy Museum. It's brand new. It's a reopening, right?
Sure. The International Spy Museum opened originally in 2002, but we closed down at the beginning of this year to move. We're still in Washington, D.C. We just bounced from one end of the city to the other. And we've reopened now, and it's a brand new museum. And it's the museum, the only one in the world that has an international perspective on the importance of intelligence throughout history. We have more intelligence artifacts on display than any other museum in the world, and it's we've been successful for the last 16, 17 years, and we're now kind of starting anew with a bigger and better facility.
And some of the things, I mean, I talked to Jonna Mendez earlier this week, and I know that you've appeared
with her.
Okay. Yeah, so I know you've appeared with her, and the spy stories that she has are wonderful, too. But the way this is, it's amazing that so many of these things are now out there for us to see, because realistically, I would have thought they'd all be classified, but so much of this stuff is unclassified now, right?
Well, you got to think about the fact that these are agencies that need federal budget money. and agencies get their federal budget money because the people are behind the agencies. And so there is a very calculated risk-reward situation where they, like, look, we need to tell the stories. We need to let the people know what we're actually doing in their name, because if we don't, we won't actually be able to get any money to do the jobs that we need to do. And I think that there was a very, very shrewd calculation, certainly in the 1980s and 90s, to say we need to start opening up these agencies a little bit so that people know what we do. And in many cases, there's still a huge amount that we're never going to know about, or that we're not going to know about for decades to come. But they decided, and thankfully for me as an intelligence historian, this is perfect, they decided that the public should know about some of these key stories. And that makes it to where I can write this book, where Jonna can write her books, and where we can actually have a museum like we do in Washington that talks about intelligence history.
As a historian, do you run into any resistance from the government, things that you might stumble upon and they say, no, that's still classified, or is it classified enough that you don't even get a whiff of it?
Well, I mean, so people shouldn't be talking, but they tend to. And there are times when people are want to tell stories that they probably shouldn't, and that doesn't happen very often. But it's more about the embarrassing stories and versus the classified stories. And the pushback that I get is, like, you know, from agencies, not necessarily CIA, but others, saying, you don't really need to tell that story, do you? I'm like, well, it's declassified. It's like, it's not about classification. It's about we look really bad if you tell that story. And I'm like, hey, look, it's not, I don't care. That's not my problem, right? You shouldn't have done it in the first place. If you thought you were going to look bad, you shouldn't have done it in the first place. So there's no real classification pushback because they're very good at determining what should and shouldn't be classified. It's more of, please don't show how idiotic we were. And it's like, well, we're a nonprofit museum that's non-governmental. We're going to show whatever we want to.
Well, and that kind of surprises me, because the folks that were involved in a lot of these, I mean, they're dead or they're no longer around, and it was a totally different agency back then, right?
Well, the reason to keep things classified is not necessarily to protect the live, living, or the dead people. It's sources and methods. In many cases, you're recruiting sources in countries that they will take it out on the grandkids of the original source. So I don't, like, let's say country X, we have a source back in the 50s, and that source is very dead. But if it comes out publicly that that person worked for us, they'll take it out on the whole family. They'll take it out on the grandkids. They'll take it out on the friends and neighbors, even though they're now decades removed. So you want to protect that so that you can actually recruit people in the future. And then also methods. So even though something was back in the 1940s and 50s, the methods haven't changed all that dramatically. Technology's changed, but the way we do things hasn't changed all that dramatically. So you don't want the rest of the world to know how we spy. And so things stay classified that you think shouldn't be necessarily.
All right. Where in Washington is the International Spy Museum?
It's in Southwest D.C. now. We're in a place called L'Enfant Plaza, right in the middle of everything. So the National Mall is a block away from where we are. So when you visit D.C., and you go to the mall, we're hard to miss. We're right off the mall.
All right. The book is Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board by Vince Houghton. He's the historian and the curator of the International Spy Museum, in addition to authoring this fine, fine book. Vince, just a terrific offering here. I encourage people to go visit, and I know I will next time I'm in D.C., the International Spy Museum. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Happy to be here.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.